Hope you're comfortable enough. If it gets any colder, we can put the reverse cycle aircon on to warm the place up. But I'll leave it up to you to have a decide. Especially if you have sloth and torpor, though, it's usually very helpful to get rid of the blankets and you soon wake up. Too many blankets means too much sleepiness. Anyway, here we go, the first question. For the first time, this evening, for the first time, I experienced my body disappearing and touched on the delightful breath. It was wonderful and was there an hour, but now I feel restless, agitated, headachy, nauseated. Help! Ah, it's worth it. A little bit of nausea and headache. So, you experience your body disappearing and touched on the delightful breath. You just stay there long enough, all those little bits of symptoms, and probably a bit of excitement, that's all. It's, you know what it's like for women when they're pregnant? They have nausea, it's called morning sickness, a few headaches. It's just, you're about to give birth to something wonderful. So, enjoy it. That'll go away, because usually, when if you put too much effort into it, that's when you usually get some physical problems like that. But I think really what's probably happened, you got a delightful breath and you were really having a nice time, but it didn't last as long as you wanted. And sometimes it doesn't last as long as we wanted. That's when we get agitated afterwards. We want more. Give me more. I want it again. Gimme, 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 gimme. And that's one of the reasons why whenever you do have a nice experience, enjoy it. And always say, this is good enough for me. I'm just so happy I've had one nice experience. That's all right. And if you have that attitude, contentment, the experiences keep coming back again. But when you want them, they'll stay away. Sometimes my supervisor does its job right and preserves peace, and sometimes it doesn't. What is the cause of mindfulness, the gatekeeper? I believe it has something to do with having enough of the suffering of mental activity and choosing peace. But what is the cause of the gatekeeper? Okay, we made this simile. It's actually the Buddha's simile. He said, like, mindfulness is the gatekeeper of your mind. So in other words, it just allows things in and stops other things coming in, just like any other gatekeeper. And the first thing for the gatekeeper to be effective is to get clear instructions from you. If you don't tell the gatekeeper exactly who is allowed in and who isn't, then all sorts of riff-raff will come into the mind, all sorts of scallywags, you know, like sloth and torpor and thinking and fear and excitement, all those will invade your mind. So you've got to tell your supervisor, the gatekeeper, exactly who is allowed in and who is allowed out. So that's why I said this in, I think, the book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, Happiness Through Meditation is the title over in Singapore. At the stages of meditation, you actually set up your gatekeeper. Say, okay, present moment awareness, gatekeeper, past and future, keep them out. They're not allowed in to this party called the present moment. And if you give your sort of gatekeeper clear instructions, then it's almost like part of your mind is just watching the present moment, but part of it is just, that's the past, and they're not coming in. And you're thinking about what's going to happen next, no, not allowed. And so the gatekeeper can actually keep things out of your mind, so you just got the present moment. And then later on you can say, gatekeeper, keep thoughts out, I want to be silent. And then you've got this potential inside you, this thing inside you, which is actually, as soon as the thought comes in, the gatekeeper pounces. Now the gatekeeper doesn't have to be all that active. Ajahn Chah used to describe it like the spider in the center of the web. And as soon as something happens, the spider can jump on that fly and capture it. But when it's nothing happening, the spider is just in the center of the web, no problem at all. Or the other one, it's not such a good simile, the cat and the mouse. And the cat is just seems to be half asleep. It's just laying down there and it's not moving. And the mouse thinks it's safe to come out. And as soon as, the mouse comes into the paws reach, the cat gets it. And that's like your mindfulness. Just quite relax, like a cat. Relax, relax. So they can catch this defilement and catch that defilement. So it stops you actually getting these defilements in. That's the job of a gatekeeper. And so then you're watching the breath. And what's the job there is to keep everything else out, especially the feelings in the body, just watching the breath, not the body. So the gatekeeper was told at that stage, any feelings in the body, any sounds outside, any thoughts, nothing to do with me, not my business. The only thing allowed in my mind is the breath. And the beautiful breath, just the beautiful breath, nothing else. He said, with the beautiful breath, just don't get excited. Tell the gatekeeper to keep excitement out. And then when the beautiful breath disappears, tell the gatekeeper, watch out for fear. Because fear has come in and spoiled my party so many times, a party pooper called fear. So he said, keep out. And then he can say, nimittas come up. And nimittas probably, fear is also there, but also excitement. Tell your gatekeeper, keep excitement out. And then you can go into all these deep stages. So that's how you can do it with a gatekeeper. You've got to give them instructions, first of all. And once you give them instructions, clear instructions, you've got to let the gatekeeper do its job. If it makes a few mistakes, don't worry, it's going to learn after a little while how to do its job. So you know, the first time the gatekeeper makes a mistake, you don't sack them, first of all. You know, give them a go, give them a chance, little by little, the gatekeeper knows exactly what you want and does his job for you. And of course, the deeper you get in meditation, the more vigilant the gatekeeper becomes. He tends actually to see more. And not only that, but the gatekeeper gets experienced. Because you know that sometimes these people, they sneak in. I think somebody told me, it was a couple of years ago, there was a group of TV personalities, the Chasers. They dressed up as a Canadian diplomatic mission and they went through all the barriers in APEC and got to the hotel where I think it was George Bush was. And a guy came out dressed as Osama bin Laden. And it was really sneaky. But they got away with that. So you can imagine just how sneaky your defilements are. All these things like sloth and torpor or excitement, they can sometimes sneak in. So after a while, your gatekeeper gets very clever. He knows all their tricks. And so, a good example of this, I've never mentioned this so far in this retreat, when you get to a certain stage of meditation, it's almost you're getting very, very still, just before the nimitta comes up. Your mind is so still and focused, you can actually start contemplating the Dhamma really clearly. You have this nice, almost like you're giving yourself one of the best Dhamma teachings you've ever heard. And I was so pleased when I saw, because I always suspected that was a cop-out. And when the Buddha actually pointed that out in the Anguttara Nikaya, he says, we call that the last lingering defilement. It was a defilement, it was an obstacle. He said, don't get into that, because it's stopping you going to the next stage, which is into the nimittas and jhanas. Because there's a certain stage, you've got a certain degree of peace and stability of the mind. You can take almost any thought, and instead of being distracted and thinking this way and that way, you can take it right to its logical end. You can take something like anicca, impermanence. You start thinking about it, and it's all brilliant and beautiful stuff. But it's not the real anicca. It's just the thoughts about it. So be careful at that particular stage. That's he calls that Dhamma Vitaka. Thinking about the Dhamma is the lingering obstacle to samadhi, to stillness. So that's a really sneaky one. And many people get caught in that. They get to a certain stage and they're sitting here and they're giving themselves an amazing Dhamma teaching at the expense of getting deeper into stillness. So these are very, very tricky defilements. So you set up your gatekeeper and you meditate more and more and your gatekeeper, your mindfulness gets more and more smart. And it starts to recognize just all the places you get caught. And with experience, you learn from those mistakes, and you get better and better and better at it. So a thought comes up, no, I know you, get out of here. You never get caught. Is that okay? Ajahn, could you talk about right view? Right view is what comes from stillness. So it does not come from thinking. So you might think, and it's all logical and reasonable, and we assume that must be right view. You know why you think it's right view? Because you thought it. And other people think something else. They think there's the right view. Which is why we have all these arguments and discussions, all these religions, even all these different types of Buddhism. And which has got the right view? Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. What about even Theravada, Vipassana or Samatha? You know, which is like the forest tradition or the Abhidharma tradition, you know, Pa'ok tradition or Mahasi tradition. You know, which is the right tradition? And they all say they've got the right view. So the question is, how the heck can you know? And in Buddhism, this is a very good answer. You can only be sure that your view is straight when the five hindrances have been overcome. When there's no sort of sensory desire, no ill will. Desire means you only see what you want to see. Ill will means I'm not going to see anything, which makes me love that person I'm angry at. So, ill will is also some denial, a bending of the truth, because you don't want to see any redeeming qualities in things. And you've got sloth and torpor, because you're dull, you can't see much anyway. Restlessness, you can't be quickly enough, you can't be slow enough, rather, to see anything. You can't stay on something long enough for it to really teach you what it truly is. And doubt is another form of restlessness. Doubting what you're seeing rather than just collecting the data long enough to find out. So five hindrances distort your perception. So you can't see what's really there. You can't get right view. So if you want to get right view, you have to abandon the five hindrances. Long enough for you to see clearly. And when those five hindrances are abandoned, it means that you have the data in front of you and it's only a matter of time when the data tells you what the truth is. Which is why the Buddha often said, Samadhi Paccaya Yata Buddha Yana Dasaman. Many, hundred times, 20, 30, 40, 50 times probably in the suttas. And that means samadhi, stillness, is a cause for seeing things as they truly are, for getting right view. Which is why I teach like this, to get you as still as possible, till all those hindrances are totally absent. So you're still, you're peaceful, you've got no desire, don't want anything, just totally content, this is good enough. No ill will, no sloth and torpor, bright, brilliant, still, poised. Then you can see things as they truly are. And what you see is called right view. I'm not going to tell you what right view is, because this is the point. You don't get right view from listening to a monk, or listening to a nun, or reading a book. You get right view from being still. So it's not what you're taught, it's what you see. Is that okay? Very good. If I make progress in meditation, like the beautiful breath, or lose the breath, I'm then hampered by grandiose, egocentric thoughts, like how I will become enlightened and save the world and be a famous Ajahn. Well, maybe you might. It's silly and ironic that my ego claims the small progress as its own, and then limits further progress. This is followed by a period of self-destructive criticism. I can long even follow the breath. Do you have any words to reduce, eventually stop this bipolar cycle in meditation? I was told once that Siddhartha was bipolar before his enlightenment. Is there any truth and evidence to support this claim? I don't know, because nobody actually really knows what Siddhartha was up to, what his mind was. We know roughly what he did. But just because, you know, he went into extremes of self-mortification, you can't read too much into that he was bipolar. So I think that's going a bit too far. But nevertheless, when you've had your meditation and you start losing the breath, you get grandiose egocentric thoughts like how I'll become enlightened and save the world and become a famous Ajahn. Your heart's in the right place. You want to save the world, but you know, sometimes instead of trying to save the world, just try and save one person. You. Start with you first of all, and then you can work to the next person. The world's a very, very big place. So you keep it humble, keep it, which is something within your grasp. The trouble with ego, it just wants to control the whole world, and it forgets that, you know, that your main job is to make yourself at peace. And sometimes the people don't realize just how much you will help the world if you're at peace, if you're kind, and if you're wise. Because you can just work out how many people do you meet every day in your life. And how many, all those people you affect. If you're a kind, caring person, just being you without even saying anything, just being around others affects them. If you're angry and upset and depressed, that brings other people down. So it's amazing just how you can affect other people by training yourself to be more peaceful, more kind, more wise. So that you've done something, you progress in meditation, you have a beautiful breath or you lost the breath, that's enough. Just doing that is a great service for other beings. Just being peaceful. We often say, remember, so many other people have to put up with you. So if you're more peaceful and kind and wise, you know, you're giving a great benefit to others. But the ego, this is a problem with our way we've been brought up. You know, we're all into achievements. You know, that you get your degrees, you get your certificates. And I remember my first certificate, which I got, was swimming 25 yards in a swimming pool. I was so proud of swimming 25 yards in the swimming pool. I got my swimming certificate. And from that time on, you tended to accumulate certificates. But when I became a Buddhist, I realized how stupid they were. You know, as in Cambridge, they got an MA, and I was a mug when that certificate came. And so, you know, I never saw it. And so when I went to visit my mother, I saw these old certificates and said, I'm a monk now, I don't need those. And so I tore them up and I put them in the waste bin. My mother never said anything, but an hour later I saw her at the kitchen table, patiently putting them all together. I felt so bad and so low, you know, because, you know, I didn't want them, but my mother was proud of them. And she never said anything, but she was putting them all together just with tape to make sure they were all in one piece again. I felt terrible what I'd done to my poor mum. So there are things to be proud of. Other people are proud. So if you've got some good meditation, good breath, great, well done. So don't be afraid of praise. One of the stories which I've been telling many, many times, some of you may know that I think was it 2004, I think it was, I was given this medal, this John Curtin medal from Curtin University for my work here. So I went to the university to receive it in a big ceremony, and you know, being a sort of a ceremonial thing, you had to give a speech. And my speech was, I think I mentioned this to Nolama a week or two ago, my speech was, it's very great honour to be given this medal, and I wouldn't have been able to do all this work without the help of my fellow monks and nuns and lay people. And anyway, that there's many more people in the community who deserve it more than I do. But nevertheless, thank you very much. And the next year, I went to the ceremony of somebody else, and they did an amazing job, and I was just so impressed with just what great people they were. And when they gave their speech, their acceptance speech, they say, well, I'm very proud to receive this honour, but I wouldn't have been able to get this honour without the help of all the other people behind me and my team, and there's many poor people who deserve it more than me. And it's exactly the same speech I gave the year before, just with a few changes. And I thought, actually, that guy was wrong. When I was actually in the audience listening, I said, you do deserve that medal. You know, you have done an amazing thing. It was actually Professor Joffrey who did the Brown's Alternative Therapy Center in Charlie Gardner's Hospital. You know, where people are being treated with cancer, then go to this alternative therapy center, and after they come out from radiation therapy or chemotherapy or surgery, whatever they're doing, they come out there and they've got this place where they can get Reiki, foot massage, homeopathy, anything goes there. But what was really happening there was somebody was being kind to you and paying attention to you. And that kindness, that attention was having a huge positive effect on the recovery rate of everybody who went into it. And so this doctor, he put his reputation on the line, Professor Joffrey, to make this happen, you know, for helping out people. It was an amazing thing he did. And I thought, you deserve that. And I look back on the year before when I got it, and I thought, maybe I deserved it too. And actually I did, otherwise they wouldn't have given it to me. And so now, if somebody sort of gives me a medal, the next medal I get, if I do an acceptance speech, I'm going to say, thank you very much, I deserve this. Well, why not? Because all this committee, they've investigated and they've made a judgment. If I say I don't deserve this, I'm saying you guys and girls were wrong. But why is it it's not done to say I deserve this? And that's a mistake of human beings. So if you had a good meditation, you deserved it. Well done. That's not ego. That's just being truthful and honest. But why do we always reject praise and we always get into criticism? So, you had a good meditation. Well done. And when you receive praise, you don't get big-headed. You get big-hearted. Totally different. Try it. It says that you've done a very good meditation. Well done. Well, that's really nice. You've improved the chances of getting another good meditation. Because the mind responds to praise. It doesn't respond to criticism. Well, that's not ego. Be careful. So you're just celebrating something's working. And with meditation, because all the deep meditations, whether it's beautiful breath or whatever, they're all based on actually letting go of the ego. So really the ego is just celebrating its own demise, its own disappearance. So there's no danger there. The deeper the meditation, the more you can feel praise because there's hardly any ego left in those deeper stages. These are all stages of letting go of the ego. The more you want, the more you're proud, the more you sort of try and hold on to these things, the less likely they are of coming. So the deeper you get, well done, you're getting a bigger heart. You're not getting a bigger ego. Ajahn, I frequently do the Bhutto meditation while lying down to sleep. On several occasions, I was awakened shortly thereafter by loud breathing sounds. Wow, this is scary. You're doing Bhutto, and on several occasions I was awakened shortly thereafter by loud breathing sounds, only to realize it was my own breathing. Ah, what a shame. I actually remember on one of the prison visits I was doing, that one of my prisoners, it was just up the road in Carnet, there's about a group of six or seven people there, we'd meditate once a week. And then, sort of, he started snoring. But he heard himself snoring, and it woke him up, and he said, who's snoring? And, you know, it was him, but all the other sort of prisoners, they just fell around laughing. He said, it's you, what? He heard himself snoring. So, we do that. We can sort of hear our own breathing. Is it okay to fall asleep while meditating? If you're laying down, the chance of you falling asleep are much greater. So, you know, if you really are tired, you know, instead of meditating and falling asleep, lay down and fall asleep. Do it properly. If it's time to fall asleep, now go on your bed and fall asleep. It's much more comfortable than sitting here trying to fall asleep. So you just ask your mind, ask your body what it wants, what it needs, and listen to it. And if you'd only ask your body and listen to it and said, look, I'm really tired, please, I need to go to bed. But you didn't listen to it, so you tried to sort of meditate, and you fell asleep anyway. So it's not wrong to fall asleep while meditating, but it's just a bit of a waste of time. You're getting still and peaceful, you're just not there to enjoy it. Last retreat you mentioned a Vietnamese monk who did not move for the whole retreat which was supposed to be leading. Is it safe to assume he became enlightened during that time since he was in jhana for so long? Oh, that's one of those great stories. About, you know how 9-day retreats work. On this 9-day retreat, it was in Australia, but I think it was over the east somewhere, and a Vietnamese monk was teaching it. And, you know, after the sort of people checked in, there was half an hour meditation, then a talk was scheduled. But after half an hour meditation, the teacher was still meditating, hadn't moved. After another hour, still hadn't moved. So people think, I'm not going to wait around for this guy. So they all went back to bed. They came out in the morning. He was still sitting there, hadn't moved. He never gave a talk throughout the whole retreat, no chanting. He sat there totally still for about 9 days, never went to the toilet, never ate. It's much easier to look after than me and the nuns. He just sat there. And only afterwards he came out, he sort of apologized because he just got into a deep state of meditation. And the other said, no, you don't need to apologize. That was amazing. It gave us so much inspiration and faith to see that monks would actually do that these days. Just sat there for 9 days, not moving, not going to the toilet or anything. Can you assume he became enlightened during that time since he was in jhana for so long? His chances of enlightenment were huge. But you don't know if he was enlightened or not. That could have just been a deep jhana state. But if you go in those states long enough, it's very difficult to see how you can miss it. Devajambhavan, why do you always ask us to meditate at night? Is there a better possibility of gaining jhana at night? I don't always ask you to meditate at night. Any old time you can get jhanas. It does not matter. Sometimes, though, that during the daytime it's an active time and the nighttime it's quiet and it's subdued. The light is subdued, temperature is subdued, and sometimes you don't have all these interruptions like tea and lunch and breakfast. Oh, it's just a pain, isn't it, being interrupted all that time. Wouldn't it be better, you know, just maybe we could suggest this the last few days. Instead of having breakfast and lunch, put it all together and tea, you know, and all the apple juice and orange juice, put it all in one bowl, sort of stir it all up and just dot, 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 and get it all over and done with in one go, and then you don't have to worry anymore. So, no, I don't think that would happen. But at night time, you've got this long period of time. There's one of my friends, a monk, he spent the whole 3 months of the retreat period. Every year we do the winter retreat, you know, from July to October. And he decided that, you know, he'd eat his meal in the morning about 9 o'clock, and by 9:30 he was finished. Then have about 4 or 5 hours sleep, and then he'd do night shift. So he'd just be meditating just all night. He wouldn't go to bed because, you know, he'd sleep after the meal for 4, 5, 6 hours. And he said, that was such a good time, because in the daytime it was really noisy and very, very busy, but at night time just all the other monks disappeared. He had a whole place to himself. And it was so peaceful and so good. So I thought, that's a really good idea. So, you know, those of you who want to do night shift on this retreat, you know, you can sort of take a couple of hours after breakfast and just after lunch, 4, 5, 6 hours, and sort of get up for the evening talk and questions. And after we'll just carry on throughout the whole night. Have the place for yourself. No one banging doors. Except the ghosts, of course. But there are no ghosts in this place. One of the nice things about a meditation retreat center in Australia, I can guarantee that no one has died in this area. Ever. So there's no ghosts around. You can't have any. So you're totally safe in this place. The main thoughts I have when I was meditating this retreat are a constant running commentary on how I'm doing. Usually positive, sometimes not so. Is this my ego trying to take control? Any comments? Yeah. I don't know why it is that, you know, I remember when I used to watch the television as a layman, he always had his commentaries, you know, with a football match or a tennis match. You know, and Leighton Hewitt is hitting the ball, and who's the other tennis players? Agassiz. Read in the newspaper, Agassiz hitting it back, and Leighton Hewitt smashes. And you don't have to say that, I can see it for myself. So, and all these commentators, and they make a real mess of things, I don't know what they're really there for. So it's the same with your commentary inside. You don't need to commentate on what you're doing, like some sort of sports commentator. Just, you know, shut up and see it for yourself. So the next time you do see, like, a sports match, turn the commentary off and just watch the match. You can, you know, figure out for yourself whether it was a good shot or whether it was a mistake. So this is actually learning how to stop the commentary. And the commentary just drives you crazy. And it's not the real thing. It's one step away from the real thing. I often tell this in Nalamara. It's the story of Lao Tzu and his disciple. Lao Tzu, the famous Taoist master many centuries ago, would always go on a walk with one of his disciples every evening. You know, they would volunteer, they'd be chosen. You can go with the master this evening. But when they went for their evening walk, there was a golden rule. No one was allowed to talk during the walk. But on this one evening, they went on a walk with this new young student. They got to a ridge of the mountains at sunset. It was a gorgeous sunset. And the student forgot himself and said, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the golden rule. And Lao Tzu turned around, went back to the monastery, would never allow that student to go on a walk ever again. And the other student said, "Can't you be compassionate and kind? It's only just one sentence. What's wrong with that anyway?" And this was the comment by this great master, which really, when I read it, really hit me. The great master said, "When my student spoke and said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't watching the sunset. He was watching the words." And how true that is. If you're having a commentary, say on your breath, you're not watching the breath anymore. You're watching the commentary. And it's a very, very different thing. So if you do watch a sunset, or you do watch the stars at night, watch the stars. Don't watch the commentary about the stars. And you'll find it's a totally different thing. So when you're meditating, watch the meditation. Don't watch the commentary about the meditation. They're totally different. If you want to prove this, you just go watch on the TV, say a rugby match between New Zealand and Australia. And you watch the commentary from a New Zealand TV channel and compare it to the commentary on the Australian channel. It's totally different. You'd think they're probably different games. Because a commentary is always biased. Please indicate how seeing emptiness will radically change this empty process toward ending samsara. When there's no more delusion, why can't we later forget and endlessly be reborn? One of these things you just can't forget. You know, just it's obvious there. That's why years and years ago somebody told me, they said, "You know, once you hear these teachings, just you can't forget them. Yeah, you may go back out into the world and play around a bit, but you sort of, you have to come back." So he's actually quite complaining. "I wish I hadn't heard these teachings and I could have got drunk and gone out with this girl and that girl." And he said, "But now I've heard these teachings, no, it's not fair." What he really meant was, you know, the teachings made so much sense and they hit him in the heart. And yeah, he had his little sort of defilements he liked indulging in, but he couldn't do that anymore. It didn't make sense to him anymore. So it had a huge effect. So if you see things like emptiness, they do change you. As you always do change, but always changes you for the better direction. You feel more peaceful, more happy, and less problems in your life. So when there's no more delusion, why can't we forget and endlessly be reborn? Just, it makes no sense to be reborn. Look, once you've got parole from jail, would you like to go back to jail again? Now you're free at last. Who won't go back to jail? Or, to put it even more clearly, like the Buddha pointed it, said, suppose there was a young man and he fell into a pit of shit. And fortunately, a king came past and said, "Young man, what are you doing in that pile of shit?" And he said, "I fell in." And so the king gets him out of that pile of shit and takes him to the palace and has him bathed 7 times with perfumed water. And having got the smell out, he dresses him in some of the beautiful royal robes, because he likes a young man, and so puts garlands and flowers on him. And when that man has been totally washed 7 times, and no shit smell is on him, he's wearing all his beautiful clothes, he said, "Would that man just go back to that pile of shit and jump in it?" He said, "Of course not." Just the same way when a person's got rid of delusion, would they jump back into the shit and get reborn again? Of course not. But sometimes we don't recognize it's shit. That's our problem. But when you actually see it, my goodness. The last story in opening the door of your heart is one of my favorite stories. Once upon a time, there were two monks. Or should I make it gender unspecific and two nuns? I'll get in trouble if I say two nuns. There were two monks. One was a very good monk. The other monk was, you know, just a lazy, good for nothing. But they were best of friends. And so when they died, one of them was reborn in the heavenly realm as one of these amazing, beautiful, blissful devas. And the other one, because he was a bad monk, got reborn as a worm in a pile of shit. So, you know, the bonds of friendship are very strong. So after a few weeks, or however long it was, enjoying the heavenly pleasures, you know, the monk, as reborn up in heaven, started thinking, oh, where's my friend? Where's my friend been reborn? Because we were just the best of mates. So, you know, being a heavenly being, he had psychic powers. So he searched all the heavenly realms, could find no trace of his best friend. He said, my goodness, he hasn't been reborn. I know, he doesn't have to get reborn in heaven. He's probably been reborn in the human realm again. Because that's the best place for spiritual practice. So he searched the whole human realm. And he couldn't find a trace of his friend there either. He said, surely my friend hasn't done some bad karma and be reborn as an animal. But he said, maybe he has, because, you know, he was a bit slack sometimes. So he checked all the realm of the animals, you know, the horses and the elephants and the cats and the dogs, could find no trace of them at all. Where has he been reborn? Surely not amongst the lower animals, and there he found him. To his great shock and surprise, the heavenly being found his friend had been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. And he thought, my goodness, I don't know what he's done to deserve such a terrible rebirth. But I can't let him live like that. So the day for the heavenly being, this very refined, beautiful being, appeared next to the pile of cow shit. And it's just disgusting for even a human being, let alone a heavenly being. And he called out, hey worm, worm, worm. And this little worm head poked out. He said, yeah, what do you want? And he said, are you going to tell a story? You might as well sort of make it up as you go along. And he said, we were friends in our previous life. We were monks together. And the worm said, oh, really? Yeah, he said, look, I've been reborn in the heavenly realm. It's so wonderful and blissful and refined and lovely up there. And you've been reborn in this pile of shit. And the worm said, what's wrong with this pile of shit? And he said, it stinks. No, it's not. It's fragrant. And the heavenly being said, look, trust me. I'm going to take you up to heaven. It's beautiful up there. Want to come? And the worm was just, you know, pretty sort of suspicious. He said, well, look, before I come, I'm just going to ask one question, okay? Yes or no? Is there any shit up in heaven? Of course not! Then I'm not going! And the worm went into his pile of shit. And the heavenly being sort of thought, well, I can't convince this worm, but look, if I could actually capture him and take him up to heaven, he'd see for himself. You know, like, you know, experience, that would convince him. So he decided, you know, this was just a heavenly being, just how much he would do for the bonds of friendship and kindness. He held his nose and put his hand, his delicate, refined hand, into the pile of shit and searched around. He managed to get the worm and started pulling him out. And the worm shouted, complained, leave me alone, get off! Now, because the worm was covered in slimy shit, when it wriggled, it managed to escape, because, you know, slime was so slippery. And as soon as it escaped, it went right down into the bottom of the pile of dung. And so the heavenly being had to try again. Many, many, many times. In my book, I said 108 times. The heavenly being tried to take him out, but 108 times the worm escaped, because he didn't want to go. So in the end, the heavenly being had to go up to heaven without his friend, leaving his friend in the pile of shit. And that was 108th story in that book. And I said in that book, 108 times I've been trying to take you out your pile of shit. And you don't want to go. Why? All my shit is fragrant. It's warm and soft. And it's my food. It's delicious. I love my shit. That's what I want it. So when you realize that, you know, you're in a pile of shit, you've seen emptiness, you never go back to it again. My goodness. I love my money. I love my partner. I love my family and my house and my car and my shit. You try to take you out. I don't want to go. I love that story. It's a bit cheeky, but I think you get the message. Ajahn Brahm, this is regarding a question you asked from everybody yesterday. Who chose to come to this retreat? Not you, the world chaitanya. You will be surprised when you know it. I only know that superficially, not through realization, but it shook me off the way. Shook me off the way said it, and I'm still contemplating about it. Please talk more about it. Ah, the will. It's a fascinating, but it's scary. I've been going to Singapore for quite a few years, telling stories like the worm in a pile of dung and two bad bricks in the wall and stuff like that. After a while, people get a bit sort of, can't they have something deeper? That's a really, dumber. So I remember this, for those from Singapore, Soon Han asked me this. I said, okay, you asked for it. And I gave him this really deep talk on anatta and about the world not being you. I really let him have it. The following morning he complained. He said, I never slept all night. I was just so shocked, inspired and scared all at the same time. Because I told him one story, and it was a story which shocked me. And it was the three societies that I joined as a young man at Cambridge was the Astronomical Society, because I was always interested in astronomy, the Buddhist Society, and the Society for Psychic Research, investigating ghosts and weird phenomena. And even just when I was 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was in England, I'd met up with some of my old friends, and one of the old friends, Bernard Carr, he's Professor of Physics at London University. He was also in the Psychic Research Society with me. Unfortunately, he was in Toronto, so we just chatted to each other on the telephone. But I always remember every year, we used to have a hypnotist come and give a demonstration. Now, mostly it was for fun and games. It was students. Yeah, a bit of seriousness, but let's have some entertainment because, young people having a good time. So the hypnotist would give a lecture and would invite students up on the stage. And of course, I rushed up there as well, but I'm not a good hypnotic subject. But there's always one or two students were. And of course, they were up for anything as a student. So they got the student to put them in a trance, got them to do stupid things, the most outrageous things. And it was just really, really funny. And he didn't mind being laughed at because he was in a trance, he didn't know what was happening. But we thought it was terribly funny. But the important part of the demonstration, the one which shook me, was when he told the student, under trance, later on I will touch my right earlobe. And when I do that, doesn't matter what other people are doing, you will stand up and you will sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice from beginning to end. God Save the Queen. And then he took him out of trance. Now, all the audience, we'd heard that. We'd seen that. But this guy, he hadn't remembered it because he was in trance at the time. And so we were really interested in what would happen. Now, the hypnotist, he's obviously used to giving these lectures because he was a bit of an entertainer. He'd move his finger to his ear and then go to his nose just to get us excited. And then finally he touched his right earlobe. And in the middle of the lecture, in this hall with maybe about 200 students, this guy stood up and in a loud voice sang God Save the Queen, and we were peeing ourselves with laughter. It was just so funny. And no matter how loud we laughed, this guy carried on singing the British National Anthem. And it was just so outrageously funny. But then the hypnotist stopped us all and they asked this guy, why did you sing the British National Anthem? And this student gave a rational reason. And to all of us, especially me, I realized that that young man thought he'd sung the national anthem out of his own free will. It appeared to him that he'd chosen to sing the national anthem, when we all know he was brainwashed into doing it through hypnotism. And that shook me, because I thought, how many things do I do are from free will? And how many has been conditioned into me? And that was the first time I started to suspect my will, where it comes from. Now, having meditated for a long time, I know it's totally conditioned. That's why I feel not any guilt about telling stories over and over again, especially repeating jokes. It's not my fault, I can't stop it, so don't blame me. It's been conditioned into me. Conditioned into me by my father. He always used to tell jokes. And one I heard on last weekend about the man who went to see the doctor, and the doctor told him he had terminal cancer. My goodness, how long have I got to live? The doctor said, 9. 9 what? Years? Months? Weeks? 8, 7, 6, 5. That's a joke, but that's just my character. I can't stop it. So it's conditioned into me, so that's what you get. So that's actually what the will is. You think you're in control, don't you? Just like that boy thought he'd chosen. He was in total control of singing the British National Anthem. And it was clear to everybody he wasn't. Are you in control? Did you choose to just scratch your nose? Did you choose to laugh? This evening, who chooses to go to bed? Scary. There's no one in there. It's all a delusion that you think you're in total control. It's probably going to keep you awake tonight. Who's doing this? Who is this? Anyway, I'll go into that later on when I go into insight. At one stage in my walking meditation today, the floor seemed to be rising and rolling like a gentle ocean swell, as the floor is solid concrete. Was this perhaps a nematode, or rather just my body anticipating the approaching 5 o'clock cheese and chocolate? No, actually, that's usually what happens when you start to get into deep meditation. I call it like perception getting its wings. Because, you know, your perception is just so controlled. You know, floors are flat. They're not supposed to be wavy. You know, walls are solid. They're not supposed to melt. You know, the body is supposed to be like, it's not supposed to balloon out and fly through the air. But in meditation, there comes a stage where all that control of your perceptions, all that conditioning is freed. Then you start to see the floor doing weird things. Start to see the walls melt like chocolate on a hot sunny day. And that's wonderful. It's not going crazy. That's fun. You don't get much enjoyment on a meditation retreat. You can't watch the TV. You can't watch sort of these things. You've got your own show there. Wow, this is great. Enjoy it. Because it doesn't last very long. You know, it's just perception, just playing around. One of the first times that happened to me in this monastery in Thailand, I was going past the bathing place, and I saw hanging on the line a black towel, like a body towel for washing. And I stopped and thought, never in my life have I seen a black towel. They're usually white, yellow, orange, but never a black one. I don't think if you go into Myers, you'd never find a black towel. And I thought, this is weird. And I just stared at it for about a minute or two, and then it changed back to white again. Wow, what's going on? And I realized just, you know, white or black, all these colors, you actually add that with your mind. These are just wavelengths of light hitting your retina. It's how you interpret it. And it's that thing from the interpretation, that's what's starting to be free to interpret it in ways I'd never been taught before. And that's why you've been told that floors are flat. But after a while, you free that perception, you can see them in different ways, rolling. Now, you're not going mad, you're not going crazy, because this just happens in deep meditation. And it just, when you leave here, you just go back to normal again. But it's happening here. Wonderful. You start to perceive things in different ways. Now you may be able to see what you thought was permanent to be impermanent. Maybe what you thought was suffering is actually happiness. You're bending your perceptions, you're allowing them to be free, so your conditioned way of looking at things is being challenged and broken. You're being able to see things as they really are, not as you've been taught to see them. So that's usually a really good thing to do that. So someone's getting somewhere. Can you speak some more about our illusion of willpower? Whoever wrote that, you had no choice but to write that question. Did you? Why did you write it? Or rather, who wrote it? Was it you? Or was it just a conditioned response? In your talk last evening, you spoke of the meditation on the body is more gross than meditation on the breath. Can you expand on this, please? Could we all do a loving kindness meditation together, please? At the end of the retreat, we all do a loving kindness meditation. So that's coming up to look forward to. But anyway, we all do loving kindness meditation. Remember what loving kindness meditation is. Open the door of your heart to this moment, to everything. It's exactly the same as every meditation you do. So you can do a loving kindness meditation at any time. You're doing breath meditation, consider meditation, present moment awareness, walking meditation. All it is loving kindness meditation. If you learn how to engage with the moment and open the door of your heart to this moment, as it is, cold, painful, tired, doesn't matter, unconditional love to this moment. It's the only moment you've got. You might as well love it. And meditation on the body is more gross than meditation on the breath, because the breath is a more refined part of the body. And if you keep meditating on the body, it just stays there, it doesn't disappear. You can relax it, but it's still an obstacle, it's heavy. You start meditating on the breath and get to a very beautiful, delightful breath, which is very soft. You get much more joy, it's much more subtle when you've just got this tiny part of the body called the breath. And the nice thing about the breath, it can actually disappear. The body's hard to get rid of. So once the breath has disappeared, you're free of this body, and that's the best of all. Ajahn Brahm, I recall listening to a talk from Ajahn Sumedho, hearing him talk about samadhi headache. Actually, it was me. Can you please explain a little about what it is and how one can avoid it? I think I had it for the first few days of this retreat. Does it have to have something to do with being forceful or trying too hard? Yeah, because I started samadhi headache because that's what I heard when I went to Malaysia about, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, I think. People said they were meditating, but they had samadhi headache. And I said, I've never, ever heard of that ever before. What the heck are you doing? And they said, we were meditating, sitting for an hour and a half. We weren't going to move. We're going to watch our breath, every breath you're going to watch. With that degree of tightness and tension, that's why you get samadhi headache. There's another reason for samadhi headache, especially if it's across the brows over there. And take the glasses off. These are people who decide to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. They do it with their eyes closed. I'm now going to watch the tip of my nose with my eyes open. That's what people do. Imagine being like that for an hour, cross-eyed. Even though you've got your eyes closed, underneath your eyelids, that's what you're doing. You're subconscious. Whatever your mind goes to, your eyes look at. So if you do that for an hour or more, no wonder you get a headache. So that's why it's not a good idea just to watch the tip of your nose. Wherever the breath is good enough. So that was like samadhi headache, and it's always about sort of trying too hard, because when you try too hard, you're really exerting your mind, your brain, and of course it gets tired. So when I heard that, I think, no, you guys need to do a bit more kindness in your meditation. Don't be so hard. And with kindness, samadhi headache just doesn't arise at all. This beautiful, peaceful, kind compassion, there's no problem. I remember going to this retreat in Sydney, and the guy was taking me there and said, yeah, that meditation hall. I was on a retreat there a few weeks ago, and I used to call the meditation hall the torture chamber. And that's what he thought it was, because those are the retreats you had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You had to get up, there's a bell. And if you didn't actually get up, they'd stay inside your room, bang, 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 bang. You had to get up. And you had to sort of sit another 50 minutes and maybe half an hour walking. No matter what was going on, you had to do that. Then during the sort of the breakfast, which was not hardly anything, no choice, and you had to sort of take it, and then you're meditating again. No going back to your bed whenever you wanted to. You had to meditate like everybody else. And of course, so sometimes you're really in pain. And you just have to sit with other people. And he said, it was just torture sometimes, that place. But other times you're having a really nice meditation, getting peaceful. Gong, get up. Sucks. So the poor guy was thinking, it's torture chamber. And so I told him, look, if you're going to come to my retreat, change it. It's not torture chamber, it's an entertainment center. Just to change the sort of psychology of it. So if you come in here thinking meditation is torture, it's going to be torture. Think of entertainment, like fun, peace, joy, happiness. You get more idea what meditation is. Here we go again. Can you please talk some more about the benefits of noble silence? So people are asking that question because somebody's been speaking. So, for those who have a spouse, relative or friend here at the retreat who continues to communicate, albeit silent, by hand, facial and body gestures, so the other person does not get to have real solitude here, and the gesturing may be disturbing to other people's own solitude. Yeah, not just noble silence, but on this retreat, try and just create your own little space. Be like a hermit on this retreat. And give other people the freedom to be hermits too. Yeah, you may have friends and relations here, but on this retreat, we're all brothers and sisters in the Dhamma. We give each other the space. You may be mother and daughter and son and brother and husband and wife for the rest of your life, but here, see if you can let all that go, to be free for 9 days. After 9 days, you get yourself your wife back, your husband back. Sometimes people say, do I have to? But you get them back again. You get your kids back, your mother back, your father back. But while you're here, just let them all go. Let them be free. I always think that the wisest of animals are birds. Because birds, they're so kind and compassionate. They sit on those eggs. Now, if you think you've got a sore bottom meditating on your cushion, imagine if you're sitting on half a dozen of eggs. How round they are. They must really give you a sore ass after a few days. But mum and dad, they still do that. And as soon as those eggs are hatched, they just go getting a worm here and a beetle there. And those little chicks, they just keep on eating, eating, eating. Just no matter how many worms and beetles or whatever you put into their mouths, they've still got them open. But mum and dad do that. And then mum and dad teach them how to fly. And as soon as those little chicks fly, that's it, guys. Get out. Look after yourself. They throw them out of the house. That's wise. Can't you do that to your kids? As soon as they can fly, come on, out you get. Out, 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 out. Mum and dad want to have a nice bit of fun against them. Birds are smart. Human beings are stupid. Because I don't want my children to go. I love them to be around. So that's why they stay so long. So anyway. So give each other some solitude. Give each other some silence. And again, it's true that sometimes body language, you can smile at each other, but it's the smile of letting go. So you don't need to make sort of gestures. Ajahn Bhav, on Vipassana courses, Goenka emphasized the secret to success is continuity of practice. I have certainly found this to be true, especially on longer 20-day courses, but it's not easy to apply this principle of continuity of practice of this type of meditation. Can you comment, please? Continuity of contentment. try the continuity of contentment, just being content and content and content and content and content and content. Make peace continuously. And then it's the attitude, if you keep cultivating that attitude as much as you possibly can, that is the practice. It's what happens in the mind, not what happens with your body, sitting, walking, eating or going to the toilet. It's how you're doing those things. And tomorrow I will actually give a talk on that, what I call making good meditation karma. And I'll emphasize it's not what you're doing or what you're watching, but how you're doing it, how you're watching. Not, it doesn't matter how many hours you're sitting, it's how you're sitting. That's most important. So that's coming tomorrow about the secret of success in meditation. It's not how many hours you're sitting. Ajahn Chah pointed that out. He said, if really the secret of success was sitting continuously in one position, chickens would be enlightened. Because they sit for hours without moving on their eggs. So sitting for long periods of time we call chicken meditation. Morning and evening chanting in a foreign language is not very appealing to a Western mind. Buddhism and Dharma make sense of work, but the culture and rituals chanting bound are a turn off. Any chance we keep what's good and chuck in the bin, the empty rituals, so that it appeals to Westerners? Also, please let's remove cups in front of Sangha mats, except Ajahn Brahm, who needs to talk. It makes much noise when a person cleans them every day. Yeah, if you don't need a cup, then get out. But cleaning it, does it make noise, cleaning the cups? I don't know, maybe just, if you don't need them, sisters, maybe you can take them away. Or if you need them, leave them, I don't know. But anyway, that's elsewhere. Anyway, the cups don't make a noise when they're cleaned. You make the noise by disturbing the sound. Because the sound is just a small thing. You think, oh, they shouldn't make a noise. Why did they make a noise? Here they go again. When are they going to finish this? Can't we get some other way of doing this? That's the noise, what happens inside your head. So remember, don't disturb the noise. Noise is just noise, but disturbing it means it echoes inside of you. But anyway, morning, evening, chant in a foreign language, not very appealing to a Western mind. Buddhism, Dharma makes sense and works, but cultural rituals are a turn off. Any chance we keep what's good and chuck in the bin, the empty rituals so that it appeals to Westerners. Yeah, I don't know, these days Westerners and Easterners, Asians, actually, I always say we're all Asians. I'm a Caucasian, so we're all Asians, really. So sometimes people like it, sometimes people don't like it, but we do such little chanting, it's only really, you know, maybe 5 minutes. And sometimes the foreign language, hopefully that some of you will learn some of that, because it has meanings in it. I already mentioned the Thai word like sabai. There's no other word for that, you know, in English language. The same like, you know, Dhamma or Buddha. You can't translate those terms. Because, you know, they are terms which don't have an equivalent. So that's why it's nice to have a few of these Dhamma chanting. And it has another advantage, is that the chanting is just common, especially Itipiso, throughout the whole of the Buddhist world. And so what happens sometimes is people learn this chanting here in Australia. They go to Burma or Thailand or Sri Lanka, and they can actually recognize it. They can join in. Because it's an international language of Theravada Buddhism. So a little bit of chanting is actually quite helpful. But I see your point. Sometimes we do Westerners, but sometimes we're Westerners, Asians, I don't know who we are. Ajahn, would you please explain again what it's like when a nimitta appears and how to respond, just in case I get lucky and it appears on this retreat? I'm sure it will appear on this retreat sometimes. So what a nimitta is. Everything is getting nice and peaceful, nice and calm, and the beautiful breath just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, sabai, breathing out, oh yeah.
And she's having a wonderful time. Things get very peaceful and very blissful. And then a beautiful light appears in the mind. Ooh. One of the nearest similes is, it was a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I think the Buddha's light, you know, the Fokwang Shan group over in Guildford Road in Maylands, they hold like a Buddha's birthday celebration over in Supreme Court Gardens. It was one evening that I went over there to do some chanting or whatever, and they invited me to stay behind for the fireworks. I've never seen fireworks in about 35, 40 years. And, you know, they've changed quite a lot in that time. And they had these fireworks, and these rockets went up, and these lights came out. But they came out to a certain stage, and then they stopped. I thought, wow, that really reminds me of Nimitus. You know, like just a light suddenly comes up and just stops when it reaches its maximum size. And just right there in front of you. That's like a Nimitta, a beautiful light which appears in the mind. But there's many types of Nimittas, but the most important thing is it comes up at that stage when your five senses are just about to disappear, or they have disappeared. You've got lots of joy and happiness. If you haven't got enough joy and happiness, Nimitta's pretty dull, it can't really grab you because it's got no oomph, no energy. But they really come up, oh my goodness, they're really beautiful. Think, oh, this is really nice. You're just watching this, like, beautiful golden, blue, whatever colour it is, beautiful sun and light, and full of joy, full of power, full of love, full of everything. So you just want to just stay with it. It's just beautiful. The problem is, though, it comes from so powerful you get excited, or you get afraid. And those are the two enemies of the nimitta, fear and excitement. Again, like many times I've told you, if you're afraid, just let it happen. It's a wonderful thing. Don't worry about it. It's perfectly safe. I say there's only one thing which might happen to you, one sort of danger. If you stay with the nimittas too long, you tend to lose your hair. Oops. That's a good thing to do. So they're very beautiful, very blissful, totally healthy for you. And the other thing, excitement, you know, because you know what it's like, sometimes you heard about these, and they are beautiful, they are really incredibly joyful. And these are the best experiences of your whole life. You know, like these ecstasy experiences, the spiritual moments of just oneness or whatever. So when they come up, alas, it's happening to me. Stupid. You've blown it again. You get so close and then it's there and just... So just leave it alone. Don't say anything. Just relax and enjoy it. So it's just because of our habitual tendencies, the way we react to such things. So if it does actually come up, don't do anything. And the best example is Ajahn Chah, he gave this wonderful simile of the still forest pool. And he used to say that in the ancient days, you know, the monks would go wandering through the jungles and forests of Thailand, up in the mountains. Even when I was a young monk, after 5 or 6 years, there were still plenty of jungles and forests around, so you could go walking. And there was the tradition of the walking, wandering forest monks to get to a certain place. Usually actually you try and check in with the local village in the afternoon, because they would expect you on arms round the following morning so they could prepare something for you to eat. And you'd also ask them, you know, where's a nice place to stay? And where's the water? You know, where's a pond or a river or something? Because, you know, you'd have to wash and get some water. So they'd usually let you go by a river or by a lake somewhere in the forest, and you'd, you know, wash, bathe, get some water, you know, for your little water canteen, and even sometimes wash a robe if it was really dirty and, you know, after walking all day. And then after you've done all of that, you know, you'd set up your mosquito net, but never at the edge of the lake, maybe 10 meters, 20 meters away from the edge. And then you'd meditate all night. Rajan Chah said, and some evenings, instead of meditating, especially the first part of the evening when it was still light, he'd keep his eyes open. Because that's the time when the animals would come out to drink and play. And in the days before Nature Channel, that's the only time you could really observe these animals. And just because, you know, these days even Nature Channel is very popular, because seeing the animals play in the wild is just really amusing and fun. And I remember just going into the jungles, and I remember being in one hut, and I would actually look through a little knot hole in the wood, because I would leave a bowl of water out for the birds. And this is no exaggeration, after a day or two the birds knew there was water there, and they'd always come, you know, just late in the evening, you know, they'd just, you know, jump in it and have a wash and flap their wings and drink, and then they'd fly away. But I don't know how they organised this. This was in the far north of Thailand, and these were jungle birds. They'd actually line up in a queue, you know, one after the other. It was really sweet. And then, you know, one front would go in, and the other ones would wait. And then the next one would go, and the next one would go in. You know, they're really ordered. But every now and again, another bird would come up and jump the queue. And all the other birds would pounce on it, beat it up and make it fly away, and then they go back in their queue again. It's really sweet. I don't know if that happens in nature, but that's what I used to see. And that's like the sort of fun games and joy you get watching animals. So Ajahn Chah would do that. He'd just watch the animals play and bathe. But he could only do that if he was still. Because if he moved, the animals would be scared a human being was there. And most of the human beings which would go into the forest were the hunters. And they didn't know that was a monk, was harmless. So if he'd moved, they would run away. Even though they were thirsty, they wouldn't take the chance. So he had to sit perfectly still to be able to watch the animals. And he'd have such delight watching the animals play and mess around in the lake. He said sometimes he was really still. And when all the other animals would come out to play, then the wonderful animals would come out. Animals which were so beautiful and so rare that hardly anyone had seen such animals. Even his teachers had never told him that such animals existed. They were just so shy. They would come out of the jungle, sniff and look around. And if he moved even one eyelid, they would sense that someone was watching and go back in the jungle and would not come out again for days. That's how rare those animals were. But because he was a meditator, he could sit perfectly still with his eyes open. And they would not realize that someone was watching. So even those most beautiful and rare animals would come out, drink and play. And then eventually when they were finished, go back into the bush again. He said that was a simile for nimittas and jhanas. These amazing beautiful animals which very few people see, which only come out to play by your mind. The pool, the still forest pool, they only come out to play when you're perfectly still. So a nimitta comes out, looks around and sniffs, is she watching? And if you move, nimitta knows and runs away again. That's why when you do get nimittas, they don't last very long at first, because you can't remain still enough. In this simile, they know you're watching, and they go away again. And if you're really still, these beautiful animals, the jhanas, come out. Anyone there? And if you're there, you move, you get excited, they know, and they go away again. When you really are still, they come out, and they play for hours. In your mind, they have a great time. These rare, beautiful, amazing animals called the jhanas. So what you do when a nimitta comes, remember that simile. It's the best which I've ever heard from the great master Ajahn Chah. You have to be like a person sitting, watching, knowing that if they realize you're watching, they'll run away. That's how still you have to be. A simile of the still forest pool. That's why we talk about stillness, to be able to be almost, to watch without interfering. To be able to look at even your breath, and the breath doesn't know you're watching. So when the nibbana comes up, it's easy. So that's the last question, and it's the simile of the still forest pool. So, but I will tell you, the nimittas won't come up when you're sleeping at night. So, it's the third or fourth day, the energy should be starting to rise. So, it's still early, it's only 19 minutes past 9. What time do you normally go to bed at night? 10 o'clock? 11? 12? 9:30! Goodness gracious, the night is still young. If you really want to sleep, remember, in a few more years, you can sleep as long as you like in your box. No one will disturb you 6 feet under the ground. But now you have life, you have energy. So, but don't push it too much, but don't be too lazy either. If you want to try meditating in your room, meditate in your room, because it's nice and cozy and warm in there. Have you all got your heaters? You know where the heaters are, if you need the heaters? There should be 3 heaters in either one of the cupboards, you know, just on one of the big cupboards anyway. There's 6 heaters in every cottage. If you can't find any heaters, it means someone's got 3 in their room. So you can get a heater out if you want one, just to keep yourself warm. And maybe meditate in there, if you're cold in here. Because it's important you get comfortable. Because if you're not comfortable and the body's too cold or too hot, it's hard to meditate. So have a nice time and enjoy the evening. And if you do go to bed now, get up early. So just, you know, work with your body so you can have a really nice time. And the nimittas and jhanas are there for you. Interested? Be calm, be still, and just allow the things to happen. Okay, so see you all tomorrow morning.